be it the team, the resources, or like the construction of the protocol, Uniswap is by far the best shot. These are bullish lawsuits in a way. The thing that happens, you know, be it the ETF denial for ETH if it comes and the subsequent legal fight, or the Uniswap legal fight, is like you just get a lot more press coverage. ETH is in the headlines every day. Uniswap's in the headlines every day. Like, I don't think this is the gotcha that the federal government thinks it is. It's just going to make these things more popular.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the Wormhole Foundation. If you are a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That's why we are super pumped to have partnered with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. The Wormhole Protocol connects over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Solana, Sui, Ethereum, Layer 2s, and more. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. You can claim that by just going down into the show notes and clicking on the link. All right, guys, on with the show. Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, if you are a listener of Bell Curve, you know that MEV is a massive problem, which is why we are so pumped to partner up with Flood on this season. Flood is the only gasless and MEV-free aggregator that not only gets you the best execution, but also gives you back all the extra surplus that you create every single time you swap. Now, this is relevant for both swappers and developers, but you're going to be hearing all about them later in the program. So for now, thank you, Flood, and back to the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience in crypto, period, bar none. One thing I want to call out is the Uniswap extension. So say goodbye to these days of these annoying sort of pop-up wallet extensions. You lose your place trading. You have to open it back up. Uniswap now has a nice, sleek sidebar that persists no matter where you are on the web. It's much easier to use. If you click the link at the bottom of this episode, you can join the waiting list. And I'll see what I can do to get you moved up that waiting list. But definitely go click the link, check it out.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone, welcome back to another Bell Curve Roundup. You got Michaels 1 and 2, and Vance. Fellas, how we doing?
Doing well.
Doing well. I think we're all at full warp speed today.
Full warp, dude. Full warp. You boys moving a little slow. We had some drinks last night. moving a little slow this morning.
It's okay.
Yeah. And we're mourning. We're in a state of mourning this morning. Got to pour one out. I don't know if you pour one out for this guy. I don't really know what the public sentiment is on OJ. OJ Simpson is deceased though. Pretty wild.
Man, if he did it,
he wrote.
If he did it, this is how he would have done it. But I didn't do it.
Yeah.
RIP to him. I don't know why people think the government killed him. I think they're done with OJ. I think they got their man.
They did. Yeah. That is such a wild idea to think about. That just sounds like the highest idea of all time. It's like, well, here I could write this book about if I did it, this is how I would have done it. But it's incredible that made it to print. That's wild.
I mean, it's because he had gambling issues and he was like, how do I make money?
Oh, really? Oh, that's just kind of sad.
Strapped for cash.
Yeah. Well, there's a feel-good story of the week to counter that, which is I'm going to tell my own feel-good story, which is I have my back, you guys know, has been so bad for like 2 years. Haven't been able to run. Dude, I'm like a 95-year-old. You guys know this story, but this is how pathetic is this story? I actually threw my back out for 2 months, like couldn't move off the couch. Because I got food poisoning and I threw up so badly I threw my back out. But yesterday I went on a run for the first time. So I was I'm a happy camper.
Health as well. Health as well.
Oh yeah,
it is, dude. It made me feel So I'm very that
well,
feel good.
Well, there's the guy at the Masters who threw out his shoulder celebrating a birdie putt. So
really,
you're in good company.
No, that's terrible. That's weird. Have you guys been watching that at all?
Oh yeah, Masters week. Best week of the year.
Is that this week?
Yeah, starts today. I mean, it's
I just don't give
apparently
a shit
weather delays. We're recording this Thursday morning. We'll see when they officially tee off, but begins today.
Yeah, I went to Augusta once. My college roommate had tickets somehow, and yeah, it's pretty wild. You can get a pimento cheese sandwich there for
$1.50.
Yeah, it's $1.50. Yeah, yeah, that's what it is. It's like the Costco hot dog or whatever. Just stays pat.
And it's not fans, it's patrons.
Oh yeah, patrons. It is very, it's like real Southern. It's almost like antebellum South. It's like the last vestige of like antebellum Southern culture.
I mean, they literally got greenskeepers pre-tournament out there with scissors clipping grass.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Yeah. There's, you know what it kind of has is a little bit of like Get Out energy. You know, like if Get Out was actually happening in any place in the country, probably Augusta is where that would be.
Yeah, they don't have the greatest history with that, but is what it is, I guess.
The funniest part I think about Augusta is you've got this oasis of the golf course right there, but the nickname for the town is Disgusta.
Is it really?
It's not.
I guess I didn't spend that much time. Yeah, it's too bad. All right, we should get into, we got actually a bunch of stories this week. Maybe we just start with the one that's undeniably the headline here, which is that Uniswap has received a Wells notice from the SEC. So that typically precedes an enforcement action. Coinbase got a Wells notice a little while ago. And yeah, it basically Hayden, the CEO of Uniswap Labs, took to Twitter to announce this. And we can get into some of the details. It doesn't seem like the SEC has actually elaborated on, and anyone from the Uniswap team has said what exactly the enforcement action is going to be. There is speculation that it's going to be operating as an unregistered broker-dealer. But I've just never seen the amount of like outpouring of support for Uniswap. And I think there's a bunch of different angles that we could talk about, but what was your guys' high-level take on this?
So, I mean, high-level, I think Paul Graywall had the best take on it, specifically on the broker point, which was related to the case of the Coinbase SEC case that just, the motion for dismissal was partially denied, but the part that was denied was the definition of Coinbase wallet acting as a broker for users. And it very clearly states that if you are not facilitating, custodying, or like basically making transactions on behalf of your users, you are not considered to be a broker. And I would imagine that the SEC is smarter than trying to go after that exact angle, because let's be serious, that's basically what Uniswap is in a lot of ways. It's a front end with a decentralized protocol on the back end. Users are making actions on their own. They custody their own assets. It doesn't fit cleanly into the definition of a broker. I know the SEC has tried to change this definition, but it seems like the courts have, yeah, if I want to pull it up, seems like the courts have been kind of clarifying this particular point. I would imagine that the Wells notice, and just as context, Wells notice for Coinbase, I think went out in March of last year. And then in July is when they were officially sued. And so we probably have a few months before we actually know what the lawsuit is, or anybody knows what the lawsuit specifically is. The Wells notice will have information in there saying, hey, can you identify this or that? Or, hey, do you have responses to this point or that point? But we won't know about that until we actually see it. I would imagine that it's probably not going to be broker services, or maybe it's a part of it, but it's not something that they're going to be. There will be other things featured in it as well.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I have to add to that is that this is going to take years. And Hayden said that in his post. And if you remember the Jay Clayton on the way out, you know, suing Ripple, you probably sued a couple other people. Like, you know, those cases were filed in late 2016 and we got verdicts on them.
No, 2020.
Or late 2020, we got verdicts on them in 2022, 2023. So these things take a long, long time. And I think if anybody is going to have this fight, you know, be it the team, the resources, or like the construction of the protocol, Uniswap is by far the best shot. You know, like Gary Gensler's going after either X times Y equals K, or, you know, a designation as a broker dealer that's already kind of been thrown out per what Michael said earlier. So I don't think it changes much. I think generally, like, these are bullish lawsuits in a way. The thing that happens, you know, be it the ETF denial for ETH if it comes and the subsequent legal fight, or the Uniswap legal fight, is like you just get a lot more press coverage. ETH is in the headlines every day. Uniswap's in the headlines every day. Like, I don't think this is the gotcha that the federal government thinks it is. It's just going to make these things more popular.
And ultimately leads to discovery. So this is a, you're going to have to look at all the facts and circumstances. They're going to have to put forward internal documents, internal analysis. They're going to have to represent their perspectives. And we're ultimately going to get to clarity. And I think that's probably the best part of all of this, whether it's Coinbase or Uniswap or ETF, you know, ETH ETF denial, is we're going to get to a point of clarity, and there's not going to be this, you know, gray veneer that's hanging over our heads.
Yeah. You know what's funny is I feel like the SEC's suit of XRP changed Ripple from this kind of industry pariah. You know, you had guys like Selkis back in 2017 going on podcasts, but, you know, and now I was like, those guys are all right, actually. it unified everyone by Ripple, and I feel like it's going to be really shitty for Uniswap to be dealing with this. I'm sure, I can't even imagine the headaches, you know, long conversations with lawyers, feels like a distraction from the mission. But if there's one team I think that was equipped to fight this on the DeFi side of things, it is Uniswap. I had a question for you guys. Like, obviously none of us are lawyers here, but this feels like sort of an interesting strategy, a strategic move from the SEC here, because I don't know. On the one hand, it seems like they're going after Uniswap to send a message, but also Uniswap is well-funded enough to fight them. And if they were to lose on this, it could ultimately set really damaging precedent for them in the United States. You know what I mean? It's kind of a head-scratching move, honestly. It doesn't seem like the smartest move I've ever seen from them.
This case will be decided in years, and there will be multiple appeals if there's a loss on the Uniswap side. There will also be significant costs. Like, that's the thing you didn't mention. Like, I think Coinbase has probably spent $100 million on legal fees for their fight against the SEC. So they picked the right team to kind of go after. But this is also a political calculation. Like, you had the Treasury asking for numerous things, crypto and non-crypto. But on the crypto side, they want more regulation or more power to go after overseas stablecoin issuers. They're talking about, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Wally Adeyemo, the Undersecretary of the Treasury, in congressional hearings. They're talking about, like, you know, KYCing all validators. So, like, you know, this is a political operation that's, like, manifesting in many different ways, not just the Uniswap case. But these things will all be decided way after Gary Gensler's tenure. Like, this is, like, political theater in some senses.
So I was literally just about to say this. This, I thought, was one of the best tweets. Following up, and this is the CEO of Virtu, one of the largest market making companies, in the world. And we're not talking about crypto. We're talking about all of the financial assets all over the world. And, you know, for those that are listening, Doug says, best of luck to you. Gary is a politician, not a regulator, as the head of enforcement. And I think, you know, really what this message is saying is they're going after the big ones because it's a political move. It's not something that they think or maybe even care as much about winning. But to Vance's point, because this will be finally adjudicated in years, it's about getting the political win of starting the process, not necessarily finishing it.
Keep in mind, like, you know, I think the betting markets had it right for the presidential election that Trump is the favorite. You know, we think he will win. But in the case that he doesn't, all these people are jockeying for new appointments, new positions, new narratives. And so, you know, the long knives are coming out for not just crypto, people like Elon Musk. You know, it's kind of like the people are just trying to make a show and get their name out there while they can, ahead of this potential, you know, reappointment of, you know, powerful positions, et cetera.
So that, I took on the biggest exchange, and I took on the biggest decentralized exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And even the Trump stuff, you know, Alvin Bragg suing him in New York, Letitia James, like, what do you think their next jobs are going to be? and what do you think they're going to put on their resume?
You know, not to detour.
Republicans do this too, by the way. Like, but oh, yeah. Just nature of the beast.
Not to detour us too much here, but I read this thread on Palmer Luckey. I like know who Palmer Luckey is, but I haven't, you know, deeply followed his career or whatever. And this thread, the guy who put this thread together, you know, highlighted, you know, after Oculus got acquired by Facebook, it was basically, then it got revealed, it got reported on by the Daily Beast or something that he contributed like $10,000 to a Republican cause. And there was basically a groundswell riot to get rid of this guy. And then they got rid of him. And that is so ridiculous to me. That is beyond nuts. That is old school, like shame, like the mob. That just blew my mind.
Free speech for me, but not for thee.
Seriously. And I guess he then founded Anduril, which is now it's bigger than Oculus was when Facebook.
I mean, valued at eight or nine. I mean, Anduril is also like going after defense tech, like a very different market.
American dynamism, baby.
Listen, Palmer Luckey is nothing short of a polymath. Like, he is extremely capable at whatever he chose to do. But yeah, it's pretty insane the full arc of that trajectory at Facebook.
Nice. I didn't mean to derail us too much there. Any closing words on... Actually, just one more on the Uniswap thing. It feels like, to me, to my uneducated, non-legal mind, it just feels like the SEC is pursuing all of these different tactics for trying to take down crypto companies. So initially, they went after the issuers, right, in the form of Ripple. They're not really doing that anymore. Then they went after exchanges, and they actually tried to expand the definition of what an exchange is, even though we were showing on the screen before. It clearly, for something like a decentralized exchange like Uniswap or a wallet like Coinbase, it doesn't fit any of the 16 different, you know, definitions that they have. Just kind of feels like they're ticking these things off one by one, but they just keep walking down these routes and losing. So
I would expect more of these generally on the different ecosystem actors. But like, I remember when the Ripple suit first came out, it was like Armageddon because it was the first one. Now it's just kind of like, yep, just part of the job.
Also keep in mind, they didn't sue, but they definitely worked against the ETF issuers. Like, this is a multi-pronged approach to try and stamp out an industry through regulation by enforcement. I mean, I think the craziest thing is you've got, I think it's 13 or 15 assets in the Coinbase suit that are listed as securities that Coinbase traded, but you have zero of the people who actually created those assets or issued those assets or like worked on building those assets that are able to represent themselves in court. So now Coinbase has to go out there and represent all of these different assets on behalf of, I mean, the tactics are kind of like not altruistic in my mind. They decided like, oh, we're not going to go after the issues. We're going to choke off the point of economic vitality of these different issuers, which is the exchanges. And, you know, we'll see how that goes. But I'm with Vance. I think the proof is in the pudding, and there has been much success so far.
Yeah. And that Doug quote says it all. That Doug, head of one of the largest market makers in the world. It's not, because sometimes, you know, we live in our own little bubble, and is this just a crypto thing? But it's not. Tons of other people feel like this. Large financial players, politicians, and policymakers on both sides of the aisle, everyone's just looking at the SEC and saying, what are you doing? So I guess... Yeah, I do not wish you good luck, sirs. So there you go. All right, let's talk about, you guys have, there's a little bit of news coming out of the framework land. You guys co-led a very big round. I don't want to steal the spotlight here. Do you guys want to talk about the news on your side of the fence? Maybe some semi-pseudonymous founders as a hint drawn there?
Yep. I mean, yeah, we're co-leading a $100 million round into Barrachain.
Go!
Yeah, thank you.
Congrats, guys.
I mean, the first time we met Barrachain, we were like, "What is going on here with these anonymous cartoon bears building a blockchain?" The meme is that the chain was literally not real; it was never going to launch. But I think once we dug in more and more, just like how talented and smart these guys are. You know, like they're pseudonymous. You can kind of figure out who they are just like Googling if you really want to, but extremely, extremely talented team from, you know, from very large tech companies in the traditional world, a very thoughtful approach to the actual architecture of the chain. And they're calling it like a like an Ethereum adjacent chain with a proof of liquidity powered staking mechanism. And kind of what proof of liquidity is you're obviously staking the tokens to secure the chain, but you're also staking them on the different primitives in the chain to bootstrap them and keep them liquid. And so like you can think of this as like, you know, bootstrapping the DeFi ecosystem, bootstrapping, you know, probably different like meme coins. Like it's like a continuous grant program that is meant to accelerate the adoption of the actual underlying primitives. And I think that's like one thing that we noticed working with folks like OP, where the grant programs are kind of subject to this like meat space intervention where it becomes this political thing. And so all of that, the construction of the chain, the talent of the team, the proof of liquidity staking mechanism, and then just like the bears too. Like I think over the long, long term, where our thesis is increasingly going is that basically all underlying tech and financial primitives will be commoditized. The only thing that will matter in the end for blockchains is branding, is the use case of the underlying asset as money, and then community. And if you went to Bearpalooza at ETH Denver, like they blew the thing out, like, you know, packed wall to wall, like they're doing talks in there. Like they all have like the fucking bear heads on. And then there's like people, you know, like paying like super close attention at the front. And then there's like people like drinking beers in the back and like talking to each other. Like it feels like a very, just like it's an awesome community. We really like the guys and we're proud to be investors.
Very excited.
I feel like you can feel that community thing when it feels like organic and real and fun and exciting. It's so noticeable when it's there versus when it's not, you know?
And it's hard to create and it's really hard to also maintain.
Yeah.
And if you've been able to do both, it is a huge defensible moat.
Nice. So what, I don't know if you guys can, you know, talk about any specifics here, but what should folks be looking for on the horizon for bear chain related stuff this year? Are these trade secrets?
No trade secrets.
There's no trade secrets. There's no MNBI here, but I mean, it's going to be a big couple quarters for launches for them. Nice. Can't get too far into it just because it's not public, but you know, you think about what are going to be the alt L1s of this cycle, and kind of the ones that we're looking at right now, like just to be like on CoinGecko, like it's like, you know, Avalanche and Solana and like, you know, like maybe fan, like who knows, like, but these are all kind of like older cycle projects, like kind of need a fresh face, new approach, you know, new community. And that's kind of what Bearchain is. Like, I think this will be the alt L1 of this cycle. And then, you know, Monad, I think, is the kind of other one that will launch at some point. And, you know, we have a lot of respect for the Monad team and Keon and all the people there, but like, yeah, these feel like the kind of two approaches. And what's kind of cool about them is that they're both, you know, EVM. And they play nicely with ETH, and it's accretive to the overall ETH thesis, and ETH is money. And so, yeah, like we're just excited about Bearchain. And I think, you know, them and Monad are going to be the two that have the resources, the community. And just like one last note on the community, I think I passed on Bearchain at like 400 or 500 million, and then Michael picked it back up at, you know, whatever valuation we did it at. And I was like, you know, why should we take another look at this? And he's like, the community is just absolutely bonkers. Like they've got like community podcasts, they've got like community websites. Like it is the closest thing to the Chainlink community that I've seen in, you know, almost 8 years. So it's pretty interesting. I think people should go hang out in their Discord. It's pretty pretty funny what they're doing there. It's a wild place.
Dude, we should do an episode with one of the Bear Chain guys in Keone. That'd be a really good one. Also, shout out to Mona. They announced their raise as well, $225 million, led by Paradigm. As a disclosure, I am a very small bag holder of Mona. I don't know, so happy to see that all. But yeah, I agree. Like the Mona team is great. I would love to get to know the Bear Chain guys. Also, I just don't know them particularly well, but should get them on the pod.
Yep, it's sometimes it feels like it's like Bear Chain against the world, because like, you know, you like many other KOLs have Monad bags. That's totally fine. Like we think it's going to do well, but the communities are kind of like, you know, top down versus bottom up. That's one way to think about it.
Would, if we got the Bear Chain guys, would they come in their bear suits for the podcast?
I would assume so. I mean, like it does kind of seem like a joke when they wear the heads, but like if you have seen a picture of them on stage, it looks really cyberpunk. You know, it looks really kind of like this is what crypto, the sci-fi vision, used to be about, and they're definitely bringing that wild and crazy, you know, part of the persona back with it.
Yeah. I got to dig a little bit into the proof of liquidity thing. That sounds super interesting. It's something that I'm starting to think a little bit about with like restaking. If you look over at Cosmos Land, how they do shared security, there's like, hey, you can use our validator set from the hub. We'll validate your consumer chain. But there's also an element of protocol owned liquidity that sometimes the hub will dish out. And that second element is pretty interesting. So the idea of kind of, you know, as a value prop, it's almost like liquidity as a service, protocol and liquidity, whatever it is. I think that's a super interesting area. Might pop up more around restaking. So
it fits with the thesis of like at the end of the day, like I guess fees do matter. Like, you know, underlying fees occurring to the blockchain. But the most important thing is that people actually use the assets. It's that they use them as money. It's that they're transacting with them. Like the buy and hold thing, that probably only works for Bitcoin. Everyone else, they're going to need to figure out their own angle to make these things money. That's the by far the biggest market. And so that's kind of part of the thesis as well.
You know, it's funny you say that. So we have been like experimenting with a bunch of different metrics to look at for L1s as something critical. And it's just difficult to measure this, but we were looking at the like the depth of different like ETH trading pairs basically as a critical metric for ETH. Cause we had the same thought as you. It's just like people just need to use ETH as money. And if they're using, that's the most liquid cross, then that's like super bullish ETH basically. So I don't know. It's hard to measure that though. That was the challenge for
this. Probably dovetails into like, you know, you can use it as a DEX pair, you can use it as a borrow pair, and you can use it in restaking.
Which is actually
the other kind of thing that we had this week.
That's a big week for framework. Let's talk about Tarak.
Before we talk about it, so sometimes when you announce projects, nothing happens. People are like, that's cool. Interesting. Less frequently is like the knives come out. And Michael, I don't know if you saw this, but one of the, I assume EigenLayer investors, Evans, added us to a list of people that would sell their mothers for 12 basis points.
Yeah, I saw that.
Like, and people are just coming after us. Yeah. Like, you know, it's the knives are out.
I challenge Evan to show me your bags.
I think that's a little silly. There was obviously going to be other restaking platforms. Always.
I can name at least two others.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the title sponsor of this season of Bell Curve, the Wormhole Foundation. Now, if you are an on-chain user, which I bet you are, if you're listening to Bell Curve, you know that the cross-chain experience in crypto still sucks. Let's just call a spade. We talk about it on this program all the time. Interop is still a big problem, which is why we specifically wanted to team up with the Wormhole Foundation. They are a decentralized interop platform that powers multi-chain applications and bridges. So that could be anything from DeFi to NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. So if you are a developer and you're building cross-chain assets, apps, or data, or anything like that, I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of this episode and go check out to see what you can build on Wormhole. And Wormhole, first of all, this is a fun team. They did something really cool with us. You can actually go and click the link at the bottom of the screen, which is going to send you to a landing page where you can claim your own unique Wormhole NFT. So we're doing this with me and we're doing this with Jason, my co-founder. So help a brother out. It's a super cool NFT, I promise. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode and fill out your POAP, get your free NFT. And if you're a dev, head over to Wormhole and check out to see what cool cross-chain stuff you can build. Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, Flood is the perfect partner for this episode on the multi-chain future because Flood is solving so many of the issues that we're going to be talking about this season. And this is relevant for both traders and devs. So if you are a trader, you should definitely head over to FloodSwap and start trading because they solve three massive problems. One, gasless trading. No more pesky trading fees. Two, you don't have to worry about getting front run. MEV free. And then three, they have excellent order routing so that you know that you are getting the best price. So head over to FloodSwap and click the link in the bottom of the show notes. We're going to send you right there. For the devs out there, you can leverage Flood's flexible hooks, allowing you to make swapping a first-class primitive by adding custom order types like TWAPs. Or if you're a wallet builder or something like that, you can actually build your own order flow auction in and start recapturing a bunch of that MEV. If you want to reach out to them, go to devs@flood.bid or just jump right in the Discord. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Appreciate you, Flood. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none, in all of crypto. Here's how I would divide the protocol today. There's a web part, a mobile part, and an extension part. You can say goodbye to the pop-up wallet extension. It's just not great from a UX perspective. Now what they've delivered is this nice, clean sidebar where you can just very easily track swaps, sign transactions, send or receive crypto anywhere. Just a huge UX improvement. On the web part of it, huge improvements here. You can buy and sell 700 plus tokens at your price, on your terms, and they've got limit orders, which are powered by Uniswap X, and there's gasless. They've also got real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, project information, all this cool stuff that just really improves your UX trading on the web. And again, all of this is powered by the smartest protocol in terms of Uniswap or Uniswap X. Click the link at the bottom. Uniswap extension is in alpha right now, and we'll see what we can do about getting you moved up that list. Thank you very much, Uniswap.
Let's talk a little bit about, I'm curious about Karrick's decision to, restaking platform, it seems like the strategic differentiation, you guys would know much better than me, but is to be more asset agnostic. So it's not just restaked ETH. They're going to accept all different types of assets. I actually thought people were, one that didn't get enough interest was USDC. Like, that is a pretty interesting restaked asset, especially in a bear market. I don't know, anything that you could speak to, like the strategy, like pros and cons of doing like all assets versus being specific to ETH or Solana or TR or something like that.
I mean, I think that's exactly it. Each asset will, number one, garner interest from that community. Number two, provide a different security model depending on what the asset is and how it trades. And if you're ETH based, I think that there is a lot of just like concentration risk. Where you're not going to be able to have the connections to other communities or the potential risk of, let's say, you know, ETH goes down, whatever, 20-30%. Does that mean your entire security model for everything that's built on top of you goes down 20-30%? You need to have the diversity to be able to have that security model. I mean, I do think that that is an important variable here. I think the other one is just like, how much security is actually needed? Like, how much economic value is needed to provide the right amount of security for these ecosystems? It seems like we've kind of blown the lid off in terms of where, you know, that $14 billion amount is trending relative to what will actually be needed when these things launch. And so, you know, the other approach here is starting smaller and frankly, like limiting on the way up and finding, you know, reasonable growth vectors versus just unlimited, no cap TVL growth.
The other thing that is important to understand about Karrick is that, you know, the Eigenlayer approach is to draw all the liquidity onto ETH-L1, and that does work for ETH-based assets. For all the other chains in the world, the Karrick proposition is like, we're going to bring liquidity to you. Like, we are going to bring a robust LRT-based DeFi ecosystem to you versus trying to suck the liquidity away from your chain. And, you know, this is still ETH aligned. Like, this is still going to be predominantly ETH focused, but this is just like a different approach to the problem. And I think, you know, no matter what, you know, nasty stuff is said about like us, like, you know, I think the selling our mother for 12 basis points is like a little offensive, but like, it's like mostly funny. But like, you know, you had that for the Karrick team too. And I'm like, we're just not going to stoop to that level. Like, we still really like Eigenlayer. We're large depositors. Like, you can't make us hate you, even though, you know, it might be the not the same vice versa. But, you know, we should be allowing competition in this space. Like, if there is no product live, and frankly, even if there is, like, there is no rules that say that there can only be one approach. And so I think Karrick is the dark horse right now. And that's kind of the position that you want to be in these fights. Like, you definitely don't want to be Goliath. You want to be David. And the last thing I'll say is, like, when you activate the immuno response, which doesn't happen frequently, when you just have, like, you know, the host sees on the illness or whatever they deem it to be, it's like you've done something right. So yeah. I think Karrick is just going to keep winning, and we support those guys, and they're high quality founders, and despite what's being put on the timeline, they're not scammers. That's like very far.
Can't
understand that. Well, they were this is the founding team behind Risk Harbor, right? Is that?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand. I feel like they're getting some shade right now.
They're getting some shade because I think there's some sleuths that are maybe aligned with Eigen that are trying to figure out, you know, the trajectory of events. The trajectory of events is really simple. They pivoted from Risk Harbor, realizing that collateral pools as risk models aren't as strong as building security models with restaking assets, which basically is, you know, what Carrot is. And I think Risk Harbor as a brand is not aligned. It's more on the insurance collateral pool branding, whereas Carrot is something that's brand new. It's not like this big, you know, crazy roundabout anything. It's really a simple pivot.
Last thing I'll say on this, and then we can move on because we don't want to just like talk about our bags the entire time. But number one, the two founders are killers. If you write them off, I mean, like, they were at the epicenter of the UST explosion. Like, don't write them off is the first one. And the second one is the caps were hit. There's more demand than there is supply for their services at the moment, and they're going to be raising the caps in the near term. So you definitely check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out. I have, as a non-bag holder in any of these things, Eigenlayer or Carrick or whatever, the thing that was interesting to me is, so I've been a supporter of the idea that I think there's going to be restaking on other ecosystems. Like, there's going to be restake Tia and Sol and some other L1s maybe. And one thing that I think Carrick might be, because they're, although I know that there are a couple protocols launching soon, if Carrick is the first one that sort of launches and like has, they could weirdly end up like winning the market for Solana or Tia or something like that. And I was actually thinking about, so Magic Eden, I don't know if you saw, so they've been crushing it over in Bitcoin Ordinal land, but they're actually starting to win back Solana market share as well. And the reason I think that that's happening is because so many people are trading Ordinals. They're like, I might as well like trade my Solana NFTs here as well. Although I am biased, shout out to Tensor. Those guys did their airdrop this week. Love that team. They're great. But yeah, I think, so I could see Carrick winning that, like that being a massive, you know, it's like, oh, if I'm going to restake my soul here, then I might as well do my ETH as well. Just a convenience sort of play. But one thing that's been challenging for some of these infrastructure protocols is to do the cross-chain thing. Like Lido tried to expand onto Solana, onto Polkadot, and it just didn't really work because they just didn't have there's a focus thing, but then there's like a squishy cultural alignment sort of thing. And actually incentives ended up, we did an interview with some of the guys from Solana Talk or Course One talking about this, and they said it was just very difficult. Basically, Lido spent all of its early incentives winning the ETH market, and then they couldn't compete with Marinade, who was like entirely focused on Solana. So what do you guys think about some of the challenges of like the cross ecosystem, squishy alignment, strategic stuff? I don't know. I guess those are the pros and cons.
So I think if you wind back the clock, Lido was actually very successful on Solana. Just the price of Solana was so low that it didn't make sense to keep the services going. And that was like a strategic misstep on their part, but that opened up the window for Jito to really become the dominant LST on there. And I think the bridges and bridge security has improved by a factor of 10x since basically all this stuff was tried in the bear market. And then again, I think it comes down to like, can the top 1% of founders pull this stuff off? And like, Carrick is an EVM-based L2. If they succeed in winning the multi-asset staking landscape, that's a win for ETH as well. And they have an incredibly secure method to basically take in different assets on different protocols. And that's just because they're talented. Like, if you have the best people, the rules don't really apply to you in the same way that the middle 80% of the field has them applied to them.
And the way to measure that is speed of execution.
That's the thing with Carrick. Like, look for them to like push the pace, like kind of like Blur push the pace. That's like kind of what we think is going to happen. It's like they're just going to move fast, and they don't have tech debt.
That matters so much. Founders that are just like push the ball up the hill, and I think it was one of the Olin guys that said this. It's like even more so than
the quality of decision making. It's the frequency of making decisions that's a really big predictor of success in startups. I totally see that. So
there are really good people who are operators who should not be founders, but are founders. They're the ones that need to get to like 70, 80, 90% resolution before they make decisions. Whereas the best founders can make decisions with 51% resolution.
That's a really good way of framing it. Yeah. I mean, you need both, right? You need like the sort of visionary, I make the call, executive decision, but you also need like a good operator to support those people because usually those people aren't.
Yeah. The time for operators is when you've, you know, solidified and ossified.
Yes.
like Carica's 12 people. And you meet these two, the two founders, and it's like, matchup nightmare.
Love it. All right. Well, we'll be rooting for you guys. And I think there's going to be a bunch of other restaking platforms that announce.
Totally. We welcome competition.
Yeah.
We think many approaches are better than just one.
Vance, maybe switching topics here. You had a great tweet about hedging alts. I just had some questions for you on, but this dynamic of, so basically, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the sort of lockup dynamics and supply dynamics for especially some of these early stage tokens, but basically it seems like the game, from my understanding, is you make an investment, you get some extremely discounted tokens, and then when those are about to go live and you actually have a price or there's some sort of pre-market or whatever, then you hedge out that exposure via perps. The challenge for that sometimes is that the funding rate goes up an enormous amount. You can get squeezed on that, right? And I think we probably saw that a little bit this week with Athena as an example. So, but could you maybe, for folks who aren't as involved in that market or don't understand that dynamic, like, can you just shed some light on how that actually works in practice and what people are doing?
Sure. So the first thing I'll say is that there's a rule called Rule 144, right, Michael?
Yep.
And Rule 144 basically says that people who buy tokens are not allowed to sell them for a year if they're locked up in part of like a, you know, an offering of tokens.
The one point of clarification is that if you sell them within 366 days, or if you're basically like buying these things to resell them, or if that's sort of, you know, the intention and that's how it looks like you're trying to transact in this deal, you could be considered what's called the statutory underwriter, which means that you have to be a broker dealer, which no one in crypto is.
Huh. Is this a securities law?
This is a US securities law. So like, this doesn't apply to people overseas, but like even the hedging, I'm assuming that that would be not kosher with this rule. And so I think kind of what you see is like the less sophisticated overseas market participants hedge their bags, or maybe US people who just don't think this rule applies to them. And what that means mechanically is like you buy tokens, you get like a SAFT or a SAFE plus a warrant. You don't actually get the tokens. And then an OTC desk will say, you know, they've set up to like, you know, we can hedge for 6 months ahead of time. So say you're in month six of your unlock and you decide that, you know, either this rule doesn't apply to you or you don't care. You enter into this agreement with this OTC desk, or it used to be like with FTX directly in their trading desk. And what they do is they say, well, you've got $100 of this alt, you want to get out of it. We need $100 of collateral to put a 1x short on the book, on the perps book. And so you've got $100 of the alt, you put $100 of cash on the exchange and you short the perp. When you short the perp, you have to pay a funding rate. And the funding rate can range from, you know, if it gets really frothy, like this week, Athena was 287% APY. But it's usually more benign than that. It's maybe like 30, 40, 50%. And like, just for context, the cost to long Bitcoin at the moment is about 17%. So like that's kind of like the baseline funding rate. And then you add just like a bunch based on the supply dynamics of the alt and the demand to short. The problem with this is that if it goes up instead of down, you're required to post more collateral. So like you can literally get blown out on this to the point where, you know, say the alt goes up 10x, you know, you need 10x more collateral to keep that short on. And if you don't add enough collateral in time, it will blow past your collateral level, your price level, and liquidate you. And so there's this flywheel where, like, back in the day, SBF really popularized this, where it was like, you know, you can get out of your alts as soon as you buy them. Just give us some cash to put on our exchange. Oh, the price is going up. We need more cash. Oh, the price, like, you squeeze them, you blow them out, you keep the cash, and then you start the polycule, inevitably. And this is like the virtuous cycle. That these are the real friends that we made along the way, the polycules that we started and the cash that we kept. So it's just dumb. I would say, like, don't do this. It's obviously, like, in some ways, depending on where you're based, illegal. But also, like, it's completely obvious. Like, the other way to do this is options. And when people, like, I'm not going to name any alts, but, like, when they try to start selling you, like, options on alts, it's like, what are we doing here? Like, these options don't trade on any real exchange. So, like, there's clearly some sort of hedging flow behind this. But that's kind of the explanation.
Yeah. Don't try to hedge long venture positions is kind of the narrative here. The other thing that I'll say is we're now back in the phase of the cycle where you know, portfolio companies that we have that are raising secondary or second, you know, like, basically later stage rounds are talking with in particular Asian funds who are requiring, obviously these deals aren't going through in the way that I'm describing, but that these Asian funds are requiring a 10-25% allocation of the tokens unlocked at token genesis event to invest in this round. It's, you know, in typical format, you know, it's a 3 or a 4 year vest for or unlocking for anyone who invests in a private token. You get, you know, 1/3 or 1/4 of it at the end of 1 year, and then it vests linearly after that, just as context. But, you know, Asian funds in particular, I've heard this 3 times now, are asking for unlocked tokens at the start. So, you know, essentially they can dump. We're getting now to the point where liquidity is what people are really thinking about, and how they're getting out of these positions is what we're thinking about. It's nefarious, and it's definitely antithetical to the entire premise of a venture investment. And so if anybody's out there thinking about raising money, don't have these conversations. Don't entertain these deals. Don't give additional liquidity, because, you know, if it turns the wrong way against you, or if you allow these things to happen, you could look like ICP and Definity, just like a stone at the bottom of the ocean.
Those are brutal charts. Those are brutal charts. Yeah,
1,000 screams crying out all at once.
It's just bad practice. Also, you just don't. I mean, you also, when someone's on your cap table, it's like more than marriage, right? At least in marriage, you can divorce. It's like you're with that person, better or worse. So,
but that's not true if you have an unlock schedule that happens at token genesis event.
Yeah,
25% of you can leave the relationship immediately.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's just does not. Well, I guess lots of stupid deals end up getting done around this time. So. Yeah, founders, don't do that. That's not good. Actually, so one thing that just happened today, so I'm not even sure if we got it on the notes, but it was pretty interesting, is there's a USD Circle and BlackRock are uniting for a USDC smart contract. So Circle, in collaboration with BlackRock, has introduced new smart contract functionality that enables holders of BIDL, BlackRock's USD Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund, to transfer their shares to Circle for USDC. So, yeah, this is kind of just more of BlackRock actually leaning in. I think BlackRock is an investor in Circle, and it feels like they're strengthening their ties. It improves the value proposition for BIDL. It's also probably good for Circle. Some of our analysts were saying it's a little USDC-ish, you know, this arm of the fourth estate, right? I don't know. What do you guys think about this news?
I mean, well, imagine.
Why is this powerful?
To be honest, I'm not. I guess it just adds some amount of functionality for BIDL. I haven't actually tried to hold any of these assets or do anything with them. So honestly, I'm not a user. I'm not 100% sure.
I mean, imagine the juxtaposition of you've got the SEC coming out and, you know, trying to eviscerate this industry, DeFi and CeFi writ large, with the backdrop of Larry Fink coming out saying tokenization is, you know, one of the biggest imperatives for our industry, for this company, launching the biggest Bitcoin spot ETF, having applications in for an ETH spot ETF, and doing a tokenized fund on chain. Like, it's pretty interesting. You know, the biggest asset manager in the world is basically like, okay, I understand what you're saying. I'm going to go over here and do my own thing.
Yeah. It's also interesting. You can only sell Buildle for USDC. You can't go into Buildle for USDC, which makes sense given the KYC AML requirements.
Yeah. No, I'm not even saying like this is the way that this whole thing will work. This is how tokenization is going to be. It's just another step in the process of a tokenized asset that can live on chain in a regulatory compliant way, but massive, massive narrative violation for what regulators are saying.
Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like what this does, Vance, to your question before, is it facilitates near instant, 24/7 off ramp for Biddle for people who are trying to get out. I guess that's the value proposition.
Yeah. I mean, it's super cool to see this starting to take shape. Like, I love Buildle, and like the fact that they're like getting inflows to yield products on chain is, there's always the question of like, okay, we're going to tokenize the assets, but like, who's actually going to tokenize them? Who actually gives a shit enough to like put assets on chain and drive yield? Like, unironically, we are one of those people because we transact on chain a lot. But like having these big people doing it, it's a vision that's literally been like 10 years in the making. So. Cool to see.
Who do you guys think the natural customers are of bondholder, like on-chain bondholders? Like who in an on-chain setting is like, could be DAO treasuries, I suppose, but yeah, who do you think the natural customer is for this type of stuff?
So I had dinner with a guy who runs a very, very large credit fund this week, and he was telling me all this crazy stuff that they do to get like, you know, 8% yield. Like if you look at the corporate credit ETF, I think it's like a 7% yield at the moment. And so you got to go pretty far out the risk curve to get to like 8 or 9. And he was like, you know, we buy these ships and we lease them out and we earn interest on that. And then we take, you know, the collateral of the ship, we borrow more, we lend that out, and like we can get like 9% yield. And then you look at the DSR and it's like 14% over collateralized loans that can be liquidated in an instant if it go sideways. And like, I think the answer to who is going to consume these products are people who, even in a 5.5% Fed funds rate world, are looking for more yield. And it's like, great that the Fed funds rate is up to that level, but it's also like the NASDAQ was up 50% last year. So like, what's the real inflation rate when it comes to all the things that people want to buy? It's probably higher than the Fed funds rate. But like the DSR is probably an example of something that beats it. So I think there's just still a structural shortage of dollars. And as long as that persists, you're going to see inflows to products like these.
Hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. I think there'll be some people that are, I get the sort of allergic reaction some people have to BlackRock. It's like, oh, is this crypto? This feels kind of centralized. But I just think that at the end of the day, we want people actually using these protocols for things. And this feels like, you know, part of the compromise that comes along with actual real institutional adoption. So I'm supportive of all this type of stuff.
It's going to start somewhere, and it's going to have to start in the most like minute way possible.
Right.
If this is that, then totally welcome it.
Totally pro. Totally pro. All right, next thing I wanted to get your guys' read on. I'm hesitant to almost bring this up because it almost feels like dirty laundry, but there was a pretty spectacular implosion over at MarginFi this week. Ooh. Which is just, you know, it's tough because they've got a huge market, right? They're borrow lend on Solana. They were there throughout all the tough times. It seems like all they had to do is ride this out, but I guess maybe to set the context here is MarginFi has been taking a little bit of heat recently because they were one of the early adopters of points as an ecosystem, but they kind of dangled the points. We don't know when there's going to be a token. And I think one of the founders kind of like hit back at people on Twitter being like, hey, stop asking, basically, and just wasn't super friendly to the community. Someone did this little, I think this was someone we were talking about from, I can't remember. There was another protocol that did this recently. Just don't openly mock your community. That's a pretty good rule of thumb. But there was a
there was an exchange between this guy, Taiki Maeda, because Edgar from MarginFi called Sathstart a dirt sack for asking for the token. And it really spiraled a lot. And it led to Edgar posting, I resigned from Margin today, from working on MarginFi, the research arm, all of it. World-class team, but I don't agree with the way things have been done internally or externally. It's a really long post, but yeah, it feels a little bit like a good old-fashioned rage quit, honestly.
So a community member called the CEO a dirt sack and he resigned.
The CEO, one of the founders, Edgar, called Sathstart a dirt sack for pressuring him about when the token was going to be live.
And that kicked a hornet's nest.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, if you've got thin skin, might not be the industry for you. I do understand that people asking you for when token 100 times and when moon gets annoying. But, as Will Ferrell said in Old School, everybody's got to keep their composure.
Well, there might have been also, this is where I'm speculating here and I don't know, but there were some pretty wild tweets that preceded this as well. You know, maybe a little bit of a TMI personal stuff about sexual preferences and orientation. I don't know if you saw any of this. Yeah, we don't need to get into any details. We don't need to get into it then. I don't want to blow anyone's spot up, but yeah, I think suffice to say there was a little bit of personal stress maybe bubbling over here, but yeah. And I know some of the guys from MarginFi, and I don't really know Edgar, but yeah, I always wish everyone well in these scenarios, and there is a great team there, so I hope they can pull it out. But I can't really remember seeing a early stage founder like this just resign so publicly. So it just read as pretty bizarre to me.
It happens. I mean, remember the whole Sam Altman thing? Like, shit happens, right?
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
Founder stories, early stage startups, late stage startups are fucking brutal. Like, there's no denying it. But it is tough when you're doing it literally from the Truman Show where everybody is watching you and it's happening in real time and it's happening over social media. Like, I get that. That's brutal. I think, one of the interesting things here is how everyone, particularly Soland, literally just vampire attacked everything afterwards. They saw this happening. They're like, here's our opportunity. Anyone who moves from MarginFi to Soland gets double points.
Dude, I was reading Reuters tweets, their CEO, and I was just dying laughing last night.
Yeah.
I mean, knives are out across the board right now. Like, everywhere, everyone just has a knife in behind their backs and they are ready to stab.
You know what reminded me of a little bit, those Rooster tweets, is when, Dave Portnoy gets a win over someone on Business Insider or something. He's like the opposite of gracious. He pops a champagne and is like Nantucket House and stuff. And it is pretty funny to see. So yeah, I think there was some of that energy going on for sure.
I mean, just if you feel things starting to domino accidentally, just stop, it feels like the MarginFi stuff could have been avoided. And that's probably the teachable moment here.
There's a great tweet from Nikita. Let's
see. He's got some banger tweets. Nikita Fadiv, is it?
Yeah. Let's see if I can find this. Might have to. But anyways, I mean, the gist of it is basically in times of PR crisis, there's a couple of options. One of them is to hire a full-fledged PR team, do some analysis, put out a press release. The other one is, and that'll cost you $50,000, and it'll take 2 years for this whole thing to settle down because people will write about it. It'll create a PR cycle, and then there'll be this this remaining thing that hangs over your head, and you'll have to do it. And it basically gets to the other option is to say nothing and just keep working, and it'll go away in 48 hours, and it'll cost you $0. It's very true.
It is true. I remember listening to one of the Barstool, one of my guilty pleasure podcasts, KFC Radio. I just when I need to just turn my brain off. I listen to that. I've listened to these guys for years. I think they're funny. But he was described like, he's like, I don't know, he's a celebrity in the sense he's got like 400,000 followers on Twitter and like people know what Barstool is. But he was describing when he went through his divorce, what the comms PR experts were advising him. And it was just like, absolutely not, dude. Like joint Instagram posts, like, oh, get me away from, you know, just anything but that. So I'm with you.
If you respond, you give it oxygen.
Yeah. You know, Yano's wife is a crisis comms expert, actually. She's got her own firm.
Yeah. Oh, God.
She's helped us over the years. Yeah.
Yeah. Can we get her contact information, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. Honestly. I think she's done some work in crypto, actually.
There's people making fun of me on the internet. I need immediate assistance.
What do I do? Please, yeah. Sir, help.
Also, let me just bring it back to Kara Gagenlayer for a second. So I retweeted this, but someone tweeted out a picture of Sydney Sweeney and Caroline Ellison and said, you know, on the Sydney Sweeney is Eigenlayer, Caroline Ellison is Karak. And I was like, this is not the gotcha that you think it is. One is a multi-billion dollar grippy, spoke truth to power, took down one of the world's most powerful men, MIT grad. The other is Sydney Sweeney, and she's kind of mid, so.
It's a hot take on Sydney Sweeney, but I hear it. I mean, that's just a ridiculous thing to tweet.
If I never saw Sydney Sweeney again, I think that would be fine with me.
Yeah, that'd be fine with me too. I'm not a stan. Well, I think those are all the big things for the week. Were you guys Eclipse enjoyers this week or no?
No. If you were staring at the sun and you work at Framework, you're fired. it reminded me of like the dodo birds that stick their heads in the sand.
It's a bad
everyone in New York City is just like staring at the sun.
Looking up there. I mean, I saw that at 7-Eleven, some of the, you know, those little cardboard things that you do with the cutout, apparently they were defective. And if you had looked at the eclipse through those, you could have fucked your eyes. Bad risk reward. I imagine how salty you'd be. It's like, oh, hope you enjoyed that 30 seconds of.
Also, like, what's the difference between just, like, looking at it directly behind one of those UV shields versus just looking at a photo of it and being like, oh, cool, that was interesting. It's the same thing.
I think it's the same thing, too.
A lot of people got photos in the eclipse. The best part is, like, people would look at it and then they would have their phones out. Yeah. I hope you use those photos and give them to someone.
Same. I also feel, I know that this isn't actually how it works, but didn't we just get an eclipse and that was supposed to be the last eclipse in 40 years or something? Now we're in
2017.
Yeah. So I'm good on the eclipse, but enjoyers out there had fun, but all right, fellas, I think we can leave it here. Good app.
See you next week. Later.
Hey everyone, Mike here. If you're a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring assets across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That is why we're incredibly excited to have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole protocol. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. Click the link at the bottom of this episode to get your free NFT.